Okay. Back again. Hi. This is Graham Daniels, psychoanalytic psychotherapist, coming to you again in a podcast in the series called Getting Real About Sex Addiction, based upon a book entitled Getting Real About Sex Addiction, A Psychodynamic Approach to Treatment. Once again, psychodynamic being an umbrella term representing a range of psychoanalytic theory that I am introducing or explaining at times in this text, the text of our book, but also in this podcast series, which otherwise is about sex addiction and about the unlikely, I guess, prospect of applying psychoanalytic ideas to sex addiction, even though, as I've been in the field for 25 years, most sex addiction ideas, in fact, all that I can think of, are derivative of psychoanalytic theory. Not that they're always credited as such, but that has to do with what people know, what they don't know. Sometimes people, even professionals, don't know where their ideas come from. Well, I'm speaking to you about that and other things. And today, give another little taste of the book podcast today. You know, this podcast is about ideas, but it's a little bit about writing as well. You know, our book is comprised of many things: essayist ideas, opinions about addiction, how it intersects with society, social issues, how sex addiction is treated, and how that intersects with social values, how that treatment is given in terms of format, individual, couples therapy, group therapy. One thing this podcast series hasn't focused much on yet, except in a sort of broad theoretical level in terms of, you know, social systems, is, you know, group psychology, and in particular how group therapy works. I'm going to give a taste actually of group therapy today, or something that could have been in a group therapy episode. So, you know, our book contains vignettes, as sometimes this podcast series does as well, the book being a culmination of stories and vignettes culled from the memory of mine and my co-author Joe Farley's practices. We've both worked in the area of addiction and psychoanalytic psychotherapy for well over 20 years now. I've worked in chemical dependency programs before I began working in the sex addiction field as well, both in private practice and in agency settings. So, you know, the vignettes that we share in this are culled from that, but, you know, blurred in some sense to maintain confidentiality of our subjects. There's no one here who ought to be, you know, recognizable to the listener or to the reader of our book. What I'm going to read today, when I get to it, is also culled from my blog. I have a blog, grahamdaniels.wordpress.com. If people want to check that out, in which is sort of a complement to the podcast and the book. I've been writing on that for about 10 years. And some of the entries in that, some of which are essayist and some are short stories, some of which served as a kind of prototype for the book that I proposed to Joe Farley in 2018 and wrote primarily in 2019 and 2020, and which we published through Roman and Littlefield, a prominent publisher. Also published The Myth of Sex Addiction by David Lee, for those who may be familiar with that book, in just over a year from now, actually. February of 2022 is when the book was released. But the story I'm going to read today is an illustration of some of the ideas contained in the book. In particular, it's a depiction of a would-be addict, here depicted in a group setting, who is prone to distraction, of avoidance of uncomfortable material. A lot of sex addiction treatment programs are very, what they like to call psychoeducational, meaning they are delivering information and knowledge to patients. I find that, you know, patients are not so much unaware in an academic sense of the information that they receive. It's more that they haven't really wanted to think about it. But this story is also contains, I think, a sort of gentle, affectionate, you know, parody of redemption, centered around a tradition of buying flowers. It's a passage called Flowers Out of Season. I'll give it a little context here in a moment, but my general attitude towards my patients is one of affection, I think. You know, contained with a little bit of mischief, I suppose. This passage will poke fun at certain things that I observe. At the same time, it's interesting, this thing about flowers. I'm going to say something about that. It's something of a, I don't know, trope, flowers in the culture, flowers out of season being a catchphrase here that I make use of. I had a discussion recently with my sister and niece on the subject of flowers, and I was referencing a typical psychoanalytic idea about the tradition of giving flowers. And I suppose I was indicating the tradition of particularly men giving women flowers. I pointed out that in 20 plus years of practice, I don't think I'd ever passed a anniversary or birthday occasion or a holiday like Valentine's Day, wherein a man complained that his wife hadn't given him flowers, but I'd had multiple examples of female patients who had complained that their male partners hadn't given them flowers. So that's something of a cliche, I suppose. And my sister and niece were, you know, balking at this, I suppose, rather reductionist, or they didn't call it that. That's like psychoanalytic speak. But I suppose single-minded, possibly sexist, possibly narrow-minded view of the meaning of flowers. My niece, bless her, got on the internet, Googled, as her generation is wont to do, and found information that tied flower giving to a variety of customs across cultures, funereal rites, expressions of grief, which I would suggest itself is, you know, at least a gesture of reversal pertaining to Freudian instincts, our fears of death, and our inhibitions, at least, around sexuality. Flowers representing a kind of reversal, liveliness as an opposition to death. And I'll touch on how it's a kind of opposition with respect to sex in just a moment. My sister was the sort of more vociferous plaintive, I suppose, speaking more from personal than academic awareness, personal experience, I mean, speaking of how she gave flowers or observed that women gave flowers to one another far more often than she received or gave flowers to men. Fair enough, I thought. But, you know, flower giving, I think, is something of a tradition, as it is related to romance as well, I persisted. And also that they represent a kind of inhibition of sexuality, because flowers are a symbol. This is how psychoanalysis would think of flowers, a kind of condensing, rather like dreams condense into symbols to make meaning. And that on an unconscious level, flowers represent sexuality, but a kind of wholesome, cleaned-up version of sexuality. We give flowers to those we wish to deflower, if you will. So, having persisted with this, I suggest that flowers can also represent a coded expression of guilt, perhaps. Maybe all that depends somewhat on the context. So, to this story, which again was written 2000, maybe 2016, 2017, not sure when I place this on my blog. This will be have been one of the prototypes for the various vignettes or stories that will have gone into Getting Real About Sex Addiction, which myself and the co-author are starting to read passages from in this podcast series. This is one that didn't make the cut, so to speak. I'm not sure if I'd ever intended Flowers Out of Season to make it into Getting Real About Sex Addiction, but it could have. And I'll read the short story and then comment a little bit more on its elements. Again, Flowers Out of Season. Harry and Marvin, two late middle-aged guys, sat quietly in the waiting room of the Find Recovery Treatment Center, straining to make conversation ahead of group. Restless, Harry settled for default mode, remarking on the midsummer weather, cooler than the usual, riotous heat by a good 10 degrees. Glorious, he intoned. I was just telling my wife yesterday that we're so lucky to live where we do. No hurricanes or tornadoes, not even humidity. It's great. Marvin shrugged and chuckled, seeming to agree. He noted the wife reference, thinking he'd follow up later when it was Harry's turn to check in during group. Marvin liked talking about wives, about his wife, about how much he loved her, wanted to take care of her, especially since she'd started having knee and back problems, and especially in the wake of, well, ever since his behavior had come to light. Marvin always called it the behavior. It was the reason he'd been coming to Find Recovery every Thursday night for a year. Not that he talked much about that. He didn't like to go there. He preferred to talk about his wife instead. "Too bad violets aren't in season," Marvin said. "Excuse me," said Harry. Marvin chuckled again and shuffled, embarrassed. "Sorry, I was just thinking, since you mentioned your wife, about flowers. My wife's favorite flowers are violets, only I can't find them currently." He air snapped his fingers in mock disappointment. Harry mouthed acknowledgement, half smiling, mildly if inconsequentially confused. Were the more senior members of the group, senior as in seniority, present, they would teasingly school the newcomer on Marvin's non-sequiturs, how to deal with them, indulge them, and, if in group, redirect back to important matters. Just then, Dave, the group leader, breezed in cheerfully and told the guys that the group room was ready, as in available. Group always started on time, regardless of who was present. The others would file in tardily, sequentially, making perfunctory comments about traffic, a work meeting running late, childcare needs, the soccer game or swim meet that didn't finish on time. Dave thinks of his female colleagues, how their women's group members present the same excuses, only in reverse order of frequency. Harry struggled through the first half of group. 6 weeks in, he was sporadically engaged, speaking when another share touched on some aspect of his life, silent and nonplussed if he didn't relate. At times, Dave would glance over at him and appear to nod, as if this would jolt the new member's attention. He did this if a member's eyes appeared ready to drop, a head poised to slump into a chest. Nothing was worse than a group member appearing to fall asleep during another member's share. Group members could talk about the perils of judgment, as they called it, all they liked, but Dave could think of nothing more rejecting, more therapeutically devastating for a client than seeing someone else pass out while they were talking. At the hour mark, Dave called upon Harry, as if to rescue either him or the group from this calamity. Initially, Harry's share mirrored the norms of the group. He said things like, "We're doing fine," to indicate himself, plus a non-group member, his wife, like they were a fused unit, inseparable. He declared progress in their communication, a slowly rebuilding trust previously broken by an ever alluded to but rarely specified betrayal. Dave, the facilitator, dryly noted the irony of all this loving focus on spouses, which, while the comment didn't pass over members' heads, didn't exactly reshape the process either. Harry pronounced himself patient, prepared to wait for his wife to learn recovery while he did what he could do. Avoid temptation. Learn about his addiction. Stay focused one day at a time. Focus, Harry had long known, exploited, abused, the currency of focus. "What have you learned so far about your addiction?" Dave asked, seizing upon that piece. A generic question, but timely, right on point. Harry stared back levelly, appearing to collect his thoughts, his resilient cool. In the silent interim, Dave expanded the preface. "I mean, when you think of those 25 years of visiting prostitutes, spending thousands of dollars and managing somehow to keep that from being noticed, you must have considered what made it all worthwhile. So what was it that justified all those trust-eroding risks? What was it in those women that so turned you on, year after year, one day at a time?" The sideways glances of the group's core suggested they'd been waiting for this. Ostensibly, while it was anyone's prerogative to ask probing questions, invariably it was Dave's job to go for the jugular or call out the unsaid. The most senior members smiled ambiguously, half appreciating a group rite of passage, half finding pleasure in a newbie's discomfort. Harry admitted he was uncomfortable, but tactfully applauded the process even before he delved in. Dave was set to protest until Harry, anticipating the critique, suddenly dropped the glibness and dropped instead the following. He liked disinhibition. No, he loved disinhibition. Had been craving it throughout his whole marriage, maybe his entire life, he couldn't tell. And his wife? She just wasn't into all of the things he wanted. The things prostitutes, excuse me, would not only provide, but also, more importantly, volunteer. And that was the bonus. He wouldn't even have to ask. A guilt-free experience. Upon Dave's prompting, Harry named the axe he sought. Spilling it out, he spelled it out. Nodding heads suggested he was getting nowhere, or rather somewhere, and was being honest in a way he'd never been before, with witnesses. There was a pause in which engaged minds scrolled for the best follow-up questions, the most astute comparisons, the most painful shared experiences. Harry wasn't done. There was more to share, more tantalizing, ugly detail. But there was a sense in the room that everyone related, that everyone was on board with Harry, ready to support him as he took new risks, was about to join the group truly, darkly, more deeply. Dave canvassed the room, thinking it time to invite response. "I see a lot of nodding heads. Any feedback?" A hoarse cough, not unlike mine, I'm now thinking as I read this with a slight cold, heralded a bad turn. Marvin's once-per-group body shuffle always struck Dave as a strange and disturbing motion. It seemed like the gesticulating action of a suddenly awakening creature. Marvin's words leapt into the space as he glanced at Dave, but then turned, excitably, to face Harry. I know this is off topic, but I was just thinking, have you ever thought of getting her roses? They're never really out of season, roses. Trust me, you can never go wrong with roses. This entry is a fiction, I write at the end of this blog entry. I don't know. Did that ever happen? That exchange? Something like it, I'm saying, did. And does. Regularly in groups. To comment on a few pieces. There's no such place, as far as I know, as a find recovery treatment center. That's me, you know, engaging in a little mischief, poking fun at the kind of names that recovery centers are given. They're fairly, you know, upfront about what they are. There may have been in the beginning of this some reference also to some topical events at the time that have since passed. Weather events in California, which is where myself and Joe practice, versus news of climate change events around the country is somewhat topically referenced there. I don't think there was much in the symbolic meaning beyond that. You know, there's something said here about the ironic, I call it in the passage, focus upon, you know, wives and partners. Because treatment, recovery, is where guilt has come back to the forefront. And so there's much in the process of a person in treatment or in recovery that is now more consciously engaged with guilt and remorse, the cleanup, as I think of it, of the mess that's been left by the active addiction period when much was ignored. And so, as much as wives and girlfriends, I know I'm speaking of this in a kind of male-centric, heteronormative way, as a, you know, just going with the demographics here for a moment. As much as, you know, wives were absent in the mindset of the acting out person in active addiction, they are correspondingly overpresent in the early discussions of treatment and in some respects in ongoing discussions in treatment. There is attention here to the pre-verbal elements. I speak of how a group has an ethic of not, or allude to an ethic of not shaming one another, what they would typically call, you know, a non-judgmental atmosphere. That is typical to ask a psychotherapist to inhabit. Whether psychoanalysis represents judgment is another matter, and perhaps for, you know, another time. Because I think psychotherapy, and some would argue psychoanalysis, it varies as to how much it represents support or validation, as some say synonymously, versus an effort at change. And change, although it can happen, you know, one day at a time, come to 12-step illusions again in a moment, can be radical, can be revolutionary, and therefore not only uncomfortable, but at least figuratively violent. And the judgment that I allude to here in the story has to do with, you know, the pre-verbal aspects, the judgment that would be contained in a nodding off group member, somebody appearing to be inattentive, or as is true more commonly, the feedback that is either misattuned, off base, you know, demonstrative of not listening, not understanding. There's an allusion here also to the excessive togetherness or closeness with partners in what I refer to as a fused unit. It's actually an aspect of narcissism or shared narcissism, this effort to reconnect with wives that at the stage of guilt reduction in early treatment tends to manifest as a kind of intolerance of separateness. And so, you know, a man in remorse tries a little too hard to be on the, how do we call it these days, the same page as his partner. As I said, there are references here to, you know, 12-step culture. The facilitator in this story, who is a stand-in for someone like myself, because I lead groups regularly, the kind of groups that are portrayed, depicted here. I am inclined to, you know, referencing 12-stepism sometimes in a sardonic way. You know, what was it in those women that so turned you on year after year, one day at a time? I don't really intend a satire here, but to indicate that for the focus on treatment and recovery being one day at a time, what it stands in opposition to is that which is also there with them every day, some sort of addictive, or as they might now think of it, forbidden impulse. And so, the figure in the story, the figure named Harry, is, you know, moved to share and take a risk, which is what we want to have happen in group therapy, and particularly amongst, you know, afflicted, you know, motivated individuals, to be honest and to be rigorously so and to take risks, to share sometimes the grisly details. But as I indicated here in the story, and I'm commenting, some people are pretty resiliently, habitually, not necessarily intentionally, stuck in habits of reticence, cleaning things up, being repressed in inhibition, and splitting off, that is, compartmentalizing, as it is called in the modern parlance, you know, their darker side, less comfortable aspects of themselves, you know, into hidden spaces. So we have Marvin, who's going to insist talking about flowers in this way that I've described, something that is a gesture designed to clean up, make wholesome that which is unacceptable, lascivious, darkly sexual, forbidden, etc. He represents something of the cliche of the figure, and perhaps typically a male figure, who knows, who is prone to, quote, fix-it responses. That's the point of flowers, in season or not. One last point, the horse cough, a allusion to a case of Ida Bauer, or as psychoanalytic history knows her even better, as the case of Dora. The famous case of the young woman, late adolescent woman, that Sigmund Freud saw and published papers around in the early 1900s. Dora came to represent an example of failed psychoanalysis, a mishandling of a case of sexual abuse. Though Freud always hung on to, and perhaps with not without some justification, that the hysterical symptoms that she exhibited, including, as I allude here, a hoarse cough, which he thought represented a repressed sexuality, were present before the onset of the sexual abuse that the patient Dora subsequently reported. one of many things in this story and in many stories in our book, which illustrate something of psychoanalytic thinking. And psychoanalytic thinking as it might be applied to habitual, you know, or addictive habits, including those we associate with sex addiction. I will read more stories and comment more about some of the commonplace events that happen in sex addiction treatment and in psychoanalytic treatment. My name, once again, is Graham Daniels, co-author of the book Getting Real About Sex Addiction, A Psychodynamic Approach to Treatment. Please click on the link to get more information about that. Thanks again for listening.